Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, September 24, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our headline title for this week's discussion is Not When, But Not If, But When Europe Defaults. And with me to discuss that, we have two guests today with me here in the studio. I'm glad to welcome John Helfel. Welcome, John.
Hi, Marcia.
And you know John from many things, economics at EIR Online, but especially the weekly report on LaRouche Political Action Committee, LaRouchePAC.com, and hosting on Wednesdays. This come out, and I will say in advance, regarding several strategic developments, John was in a staff meeting with Mr. LaRouche today, and we'll look forward to hearing about these breaking developments. And also, I'm glad to welcome from Europe, Dean Andromedis. Welcome, Dean.
Thank you.
Dean,
glad to be with you.
Good. Dean is speaking to us from Wiesbaden, where he is in the bureau associated with the EIR network, EIR Online. And so he's in Germany, but in mid-September, for over a week or more, Dean was in Greece. He's just filed an article, which you'll find next in the next EIR Online, which whose title is Greece Needs LaRouche Solutions to Reverse Crisis, Start Development. And we're very glad to have him with a firsthand account of the situation in this part of the world. But of course, we're not confused that there's any such thing as a Greek crisis, which is what you're supposed to believe, that that's a detonator for problems and, oh, those Greeks, something like that. In fact, we have a global breakdown situation of the monetarist system that is well underway. On the most mundane level, and John may put this in perspective, this is our last LaRouche show for the fiscal year of the United States. Do listen October 1st. But now nothing is mundane. Everything is part of the detonator that just ends the pretense that our financial system has been functioning at all, except by funny money and bailouts and so forth, which themselves have come to an end. Now, so we really have a chaotic situation. One thing here in Washington, D.C., very close to our studio, you have a lot of the bigwigs of the world, because the International Monetary Fund is meeting. The Group of 20, I hear, has had late-night meetings all night. And what they're doing is typified by, I just looked, John, at the headline of the Financial Times today, the pink paper from London, which is the voice of the British Empire among several voices, I guess. So their headline today is, Global Economy Pushed to Brink, Pressure Grows to Find Eurozone Crisis Solution. And then they have some headline about needing to have to boost the firepower of rescue funds. So that's all a lot of crap. And in fact, we have a situation where what we're presented with, what the role of Mr. LaRouche, what the role of our own organizing around the world in association with his ideas, we've already succeeded. I mean, Mr. Obama in the White House is the problem, and also he's a political goner. The problem is he's still there. We need to have him set aside. And so but our tasks is not to appeal to any party, any pre-existing institutions, because like it or not, it's our impact that's going to make all the difference. And in fact, already has in some ways, the kind of subsurface support for critical things like Glass-Steagall in the United States has never been greater. It's already there. It may not be visible because it's blacked out or because more have to exert. But we have quite a situation on our hands. And that's where I think, John, if you could begin with the kind of a summary of the overall kind of status report on this, both the disintegration but also the strategic promise. And then we want to go to Dean to similarly discuss the status of things, perhaps with particulars of Greece, knowing that that's just a manifestation.
Well, as you said, what we're facing, we're in the midst of a global financial meltdown, a collapse of the global financial system, which actually died in 2007, and we've been playing out that death as various things blow up. So you had a plan in 2008 was launched, which was the bailout plan, which then was shifting all of this debt that could not be paid from the books of the banks to the books of the governments. Okay. Now, nothing was done to make the debt more payable. There was no building up of the economy. In fact, the economy continues to deteriorate. So you have a debt which is growing and the ability to pay that debt which is shrinking. So things are worse and more unstable. And that's what the so-called sovereign debt crisis is you take all this debt and load it on governments whose economies are being destroyed and they can't pay. This whole thing can only end in, it's going to blow. It's dead. And everybody on the inside knows that it's dead. The question is what comes next? Now, what you see in the statements from the IMF, the G20, and all of these people, they're all pushing fascism. Fascist austerity, take it out of the hides of the people, save the banks, to hell with the people. This is the policy across the board. It's the policy in the United States. It's the policy in Europe. It's the policy of the British Empire and everything it controls. And whenever you see somebody pushing that policy, then you know that you're dealing with someone who is either an outright British agent or an agent of influence of the British Empire, because that's their line. Save the money, to hell with the people. Now, like I said, it's going to end one of two ways, either in fascist dictatorship or in throwing off all of this nonsense, putting the system through bankruptcy, the reemergence of for the sovereign nations, and sovereign nations acting to put the empire through bankruptcy and begin to rebuild the world. And that's where the development that just happened yesterday or today.
I think it's
Russia,
this morning.
In Russia is that Vladimir Putin pulled off a strategic shock to the British Empire by cutting a deal with Medvedev, where Dmitry Medvedev, who's the president now, and Putin is the prime minister, and next year they're going to switch positions and Putin will come back to being the president. And Putin is very much in favor of the kind of development program that we've been talking about that is the centerpiece of our alliance between the United States, Russia, and China as the drivers for global development, which involves NAWAPA on our side and the a railroad across the Bering Straits, high-speed rail. Russia is committed to developing its resources in Siberia, and then those resources are badly needed by China. So you can easily set up a trans-Pacific development zone across the ocean, which then becomes the engine for rebuilding the world. And so Putin development is a big step in that direction. And now, so Russia's ready to go. China is ready to go. The thing we have to do now is make the U.S. ready to go, which means that we have to dump this fascist British agent, Barack Obama, and his mustache, and then we'll be set. So that's the strategic overview. The whole thing is coming down. We have two choices. And when people look at these various crises, there's an attempt to say, well, this bank is bad. This bank is bad. This country is having problems. That country is having problems.
Yeah, by the way, I think Mr. LaRouche said in the last day, maybe it was the interview with you in Weekly, issues go in the toilet. Two-ply issues, three-ply issues, all these issues in the toilet as issues.
It's like trying to describe a case of the measles by going from bump to bump. They're all reflections of a larger process, and that's what we have to focus on, because that's where we find both the real problem and the solution to it.
Right. Well, let's go from that, because with the perspective, it's quite clear. But this, the situation in Greece, the case of it that you summed up, Dean, in your article that'll be available in a couple of days to everyone on LaRouchePub.com. This case study of this attempted fascist dictatorship in Greece. It's horrendous. You know, what do you have, 10 or 10 and a half or 11 million people there, and they've been just told to go into the meat grinder. Could you just summarize that?
Well, I mean, I spent a week there, and you know, in Greece, it's like 1940. The Greeks are France. The Nazis have invaded, and the Nazis are the European Union and the banks. That's how it's seen. Their government has turned into a Vichy regime, and the United States has yet to enter the war. Because the power of the forces that are aligned against Greece at this point are too powerful for a small country like Greece to deal with. Although I must say, the population hate their government, they hate their banks, not their banks, but they hate the EU. I met with people from the full political spectrum, from the left to the right, economists, businessmen, politicians, and they all agree that Glass-Steagall has to be implemented. And they all agree that once it is implemented in the United States, then it will be implemented, then they can save themselves in Europe. And I think this is a very, very important point to make when it comes to Greece and Europe, and it's the point that Lyndon LaRouche has been making all along, that the responsibility rests on the shoulders of the United States to push this policy through, get rid of Obama, get the Glass-Steagall implemented, get a Hamiltonian credit system, and actually save Europe. People in Greece see that as their only option. But having said that, the opposition in Greece to what is happening to them permeates the entire population. I mean, as we're speaking, there are strikes taking place. Because what has happened to the Greek people in the last 18 months has not ever been forced on the population in Europe since World War II. And for instance, it has a debt, and the debt is being doubled by this so-called bailout. It's going to be approaching 500 to 600 billion euros within the next 2 years, if the situation is not going to sustain itself in the next 2 years. But this is what the plan is. The living standards, the income of the average income of the Greek population has been reduced by 50%. Nearly 200,000 to 300,000 Greek workers have been thrown off their jobs. Jobs are being lost at the rate of 1,000 a day. The people are being taxed. There's no poverty line in Greece anymore. You're being taxed. Poor people are now being taxed simply to pay this debt, and of course, it can never be paid. And not only can it never be paid, as the more they implement the austerity, the more the economy collapses. So the economy has actually collapsed by 20% since this policy had been implemented. So that's what the situation is in Greece at this point. And as I said, the population does want to fight. They are fighting, but they need hope. Now, the situation is beginning to change. I mean, before we had the trade unions, the typical layers of the population that are attacked first and they move first. So at first we've had the trade unions, and then we had this explosive indignados phenomenon, which peaked this summer when we had 500,000 demonstrating in Athens over the summer and doing one night. And then there was a massive repression of one of these, the last big demonstration in June, the very day that the parliament passed one of the latest of the austerity measures at that time. That was in June 29th, and this was a massive attack by the police against the demonstrators, using tear gas and other types of gases where it's not known what types of gases they were using. Very, very brutal. And now what you're seeing in Greece is not only are the workers and the general population, but even the business community is attacking the EU. We had just today, or not today, but a couple of days ago, Kostas Michalos, he's the head of the Athens Chamber of Commerce, and he said the current policy is turning Greece into a vast poorhouse. And that workers, that businesses, working people, and pensioners can no longer tolerate this policy. If it continues, it will bring about the country's full economic and social destruction. The president of the Hellenic Federation of Enterprises denounced the European Union for turning Greece into a guinea pig for its austerity policies, simply for the sake of paying the debt of the banks and their vain attempt to keep the euro. And then now we have things people are discussing the idea openly now, the idea of having a referendum in Greece. Now this is being discussed within the ruling party, this Pan-Hellenic Socialist Party. It was just reported this week, because they know that the policy is politically unsustainable. So a group is pushing for a referendum on whether Greece should stay in the Eurozone or go back to the drachma. And if such a referendum was held, the overwhelming majority would vote for a return to the drachma. There are people talking about the so-called Argentinian model. In 2000, it was famous that Argentina refused to implement the austerity measures demanded by the IMF. And now people are talking about default options, that Greece should default, that Greece should force upon the creditors a 50% haircut, or go into a disorderly default and throw the responsibility onto the Europeans. So the situation as it stands now is unsustainable, and even by next week we could have an announcement of a default. But the issue, of course, the issue is not Greece. If you look at the discussion in the newspapers, the discussion really isn't about whether Greece will default or not. The discussion is whether the so-called European Financial Stability Facility, this is the bailout fund, which is financing the Greek, Irish, and Portuguese bailout, should actually become a massive bailout fund to bail out the banks directly and increase the fund to something like 2.5 trillion euros, all of which would be financed by the governments of Europe, especially Germany and France. And this is what they're discussing. And of course, it's totally unsustainable. The only thing that can save the situation is the implementation of Glass-Steagall. And we had an interesting development this week in Switzerland, where there was a debate and a bill introduced in the parliament of Switzerland for what they call a Trendbanken system, which is the Glass-Steagall, separating the commercial banks from the private investment banks. It was defeated, but it was narrowly defeated. By only it was something like a vote of 44 parliamentarians to 55. And Switzerland is a country that's going into general elections next month, so this would be an issue. And if the banks do collapse in the meantime, there's little doubt that the whole Trendbanken question, the whole Glass-Steagall question in Switzerland will be put directly on the table. So let me stop there, and then maybe you have some other questions.
Definitely I do. I'll just ask John. One thing is what you're describing with specificity here in the last 18 months, you know, I guess, Dean, there was a bailout, so-called. It wasn't. There was a turning of the screws in something like May 2010 against Greece, then July 2011 against Greece. You know, but it's, as you say, it's not in its own terms. It's just a way to throw people against the wall and kill them. It just, if you're killing the economy. But this is the tail end of decades of this doomed monetarist system. And there are two aspects, John, that it seems to me stand out about Greece in general, because the reason I mentioned John's name is over the last decades, you've described a lot of the nature of globalization. It's another word for fascism. We'll get to that. But Dean, even before the last 18 months, under the Eurozone, let me put it that way, and under the British Empire internationally, arrangements, WTO and so forth, Greece was being undermined for some of its features that are economically very valuable to the world. Its agriculture potential, I mean, it goes back a long way after all. Its shipping potential. Could you say something, let people know about the erosion that's going on of its agriculture activity there?
Well, the EU has become an existential threat to every nation in Europe. Their agricultural policy has been totally to support the international cartels. So Greece is a country that historically has, for various reasons, because as they don't have enough capital, is not an industrialized country. Yet it has tremendous agricultural potential. And it certainly can feed itself. You can grow anything in Greece, from grains, fresh fruits, citrus fruits, olive oil, grapes for wine and for the table. It's not just mountains. I mean, it has plains. It's the 10th largest producer of cotton in the world, and the largest European producer of cotton. Now, since Greece joined the European Union, you have a quota system. So now Greece has a quota for milk, which doesn't allow itself to be self-sufficient in milk. So milk is imported from places like the Netherlands, which is not a particularly poor country, and the import bill for milk is something like 1.4 billion euros. I had spoken to a person from the agricultural ministry, and he said there are vast areas of the country that have been taken out of agricultural production, they're trying to figure out how to put these areas back into production, but the problem they're having is the EU quota systems. Now take cotton, for instance. Now, this is a crop that accounts for 10% of Greece's agricultural production. And now the EU is instituting a reform on the idea that they have to help the Africans who want to increase their production of cotton. So they want to eliminate the subsidiaries. And I was just reading in a report that this could lead to the elimination of cotton production in Greece. Now, if you look at this Africa question a little bit further, what you find out is that this entire production in Africa is being run directly by the cartels, like Cargill. They organize the seed, they organize the marketing. Everything is organized by the cartels. And obviously, the smallholders who produce the cotton in Africa are not getting the same prices that the Greek farmers are. So this is what is happening in Greece. Another example. Now, the only way Greece can survive and develop as an economy and advance itself is to become part of our conception of the Eurasian land bridge. Because the Eurasian land bridge, where you would have development corridors based on transportation, energy links, that would go from Western Europe through Eastern Europe, Russia, Central Asia, China, etc. This would lead to a tremendous development, a tremendous expansion of the economies in Eastern Europe. Economies like stretching from Poland, the Baltic states, the western parts of Russia, the Ukraine, down through Romania, Bulgaria, the Balkans, and into Greece. And Greece has a lot, they have several ports which are already important for Eastern Europe. For instance, they have a port in the north called Thessaloniki. And Thessaloniki is closer to Sofia, Bulgaria, than Bulgaria's port on the Black Sea, Bargas or Varna. They have two ports. And the Black Sea is not the best conveyor for international trade because all the ships have to go through the Bosphorus Straits, which is in effect a canal. It's no bigger than a canal, and it goes right through one of the largest cities on this planet, Istanbul. And the Turks are afraid that in the past you've had serious accidents, so you don't want to send a lot of ships into the Black Sea that are coming from the Mediterranean or Asia. So you have other ports. You have Piraeus, which is the port of Athens, and it's the 10th largest container port in Europe and the largest passenger port. Greece is a land of islands. They have hundreds of islands, and the only way you get to these islands is either by ship or by aircraft. But the point is, these ports, if they are linked by railroads into these corridors, then Greece becomes like Rotterdam. The port of Rotterdam and Antwerp are for Western Europe. They become the major entry points and exit points for Europe. Now, the Greeks are already rebuilding their rail link between Athens and Thessaloniki. They're about to finish two tunnels, which will allow the rail line to be double tracked. They're upgrading the rail line so they can use high speed trains on it, and this would decrease the time between Thessaloniki and Athens from the current 7 hours to something like 3.5. But all of this is up in the air because of the crisis. And not only that, the rail service that already exists between Greece and Eastern Europe has been cut. You cannot take a train now. You cannot put cargo on a train from Piraeus or Thessaloniki and ship it to Bulgaria or Romania or anywhere else outside of Greece. So you see that the EU policy, over and above the crisis, is an existential threat to the country.
So, John, you may want to, in other words, these are the hallmark policies of that now is at the dark ages point of the last 40 years, globalization.
Well, the British Empire is committed to reducing the world's population to 1 billion people. It's committed to genocide. The way you do that is you destroy the structures which keep people alive, starting with the idea of a sovereign nation state. The nation state system has to be destroyed. And that's what you see very clearly going on in Europe right now, with Greece the leading edge, but this is something that all European governments who are participating in this process are being destroyed. National sovereignty is rapidly being lost, that they're not really sovereign nations anymore. They could regain their sovereignty with some bold action, but they're not really sovereign nations. And you see the same thing in the United States. Now, we don't say that we're being put through IMF conditionalities, but nevertheless, we have the super committee in Congress, which is going to impose things upon us. You have all of these bodies, which are creatures of the banks, which are imposing austerity on the population. It's the same process. Across the board, nations are being destroyed. And the only way out of this is to reassert national sovereignty. And that's the crucial aspect, the starting point of our Glass-Steagall proposal, which is that you use Glass-Steagall to assert national control over the financial system. You regulate the banks, you prohibit all sorts of the speculation, and you split up, you go in and you write off all this stuff. You give all these derivatives to Wall Street. Say, here, they're yours. They're worthless. Eat them.
You made them, you eat them.
Yeah. And Wall Street collapses. But you save the nation. And this is what has to be done. That then you go to the credit system and you have this, you spread this around the world, beginning with this three-nation development project. But you have to go back to national sovereignty. That's the key thing in starting this. Now, solving the financial crisis is imperative. If we don't, we're lost. But that's only the first step. It's like curing the disease, but you still have a body which is very weak. And then that's what all the development programs do. That begins to rebuild the world and lead us back to prosperity. And so, what you look at what's happening in Greece, as Dean described, and that is going to happen all across Europe, and it's going to happen here in the United States. The process has already begun. They're just further along the road than we are.
I mean, I add to that. I mean, it's already happening in Germany. The government's announcement of the exit from nuclear energy will mean the deindustrialization of Germany. There's no way German industry, heavy industry, chemical industry, the ceramic industry, even the machine tool, and other types of industry can be sustained if you close down the nuclear power stations that supply 40% of Germany's power. That cannot be replaced by importing energy from all over Europe. The energy grid, there's a severe shortage throughout Europe at this point. There's no place where there is a surplus of electricity being produced, except in France and some other places. And this surplus is rapidly disappearing as these nuclear power stations are being taken offline. Now, in Greece itself, on this whole question of exerting national sovereignty, it is interesting because this is what the people of Greece are demanding. If you look at the Indignados movement in Greece, if you look at those demonstrations that they had over the summer, you see that everyone is carrying a Greek flag. Now, this is not usual. This was not the custom over the last 20 or 30 years for Greeks to, except if they're at a football game, to wave Greek flags, because if you remember, Greece had a military dictatorship between 1967 and 1975, so these displays of nationalism always had overtones of the dictatorship. But now people see that the destruction, they have nothing left except their identity as the nation of Greece. And they are demanding that their government, that their elected officials defend the nation of Greece. And this is what is, I think, very, very interesting about the Indignados movements, in particularly Portugal and Spain. Because they are demanding, as I said, the defense of the state, because the defense of the nation is the only way that that a people can guarantee a future for themselves and the next generation. And this is very, very important, a very important thing to tap at this point. And it has, this idea is not spread yet to places like France and Germany. This idea, because the crisis has not reached the existential threat, at least is not perceived as the existential threat that is perceived in places like Greece.
Right. Well, one thing, and you take Italy, where, John, I understand that some of the rating agencies, maybe Moody's and others, downgraded it again yesterday. So what, in the sense of reality? What are they, the vultures? But do you find, Dean, that people in Italy, there's people talk about Britannica, talk about the London and the British as the enemy, many layers of the population. I'm not talking about masses of people. What about in Greece when it comes to seeing what London or what the pedigree is of this?
Well, the Greeks naturally hate the British. They have a long history of being in conflict with the British.
And the Elgin
the British
marbles.
Like the, I mean, some people think that the British, you know, manipulated the situation to give Greece independence in the 19th century because they didn't like the Ottoman Empire. This is quite a lie. I mean, the reality was that at that period, the Ottoman Empire was in fact an ally, or let's say it was used by the British, as it was controlled by the British to be used against Russia. And
you're talking about 1840-ish?
No, we're talking about 1821.
1821. Yeah, thank you.
We're talking about the middle of the Congress of Vienna.
Okay.
And when the Greeks launched their independence struggle, this had an electrifying effect among the Republican movement throughout Europe and the United States. I mean, there was tremendous support in the United States for the Greek Revolution. You know, everyone remembers the man who gave the 5-minute speech at Gettysburg, Lincoln, but no one remembers who gave the much longer speech, the 2-hour speech. That was Edward Everett. And Everett was also famous because he led the pro-Greek independence movement in the United States. And this was an electrifying, this electrified the Republicans because it happened right in the middle of the Congress of Vienna. And and of course, it was immortalized by none other than Percy Bysshe Shelley, who was close friend with one of the Greek revolutionaries, and he wrote the play The Hellenes. So, you know, the Greeks have no illusions about the British. Now, if you take the Greek ship owners, everyone thinks, you know, Onassis, Jackie Onassis, you know, these big Greek ship owners, you know, isn't this part of the Greek nation? In this part of the Greek economy? Well, in reality, it isn't. You have two types of shipping in Greece. You have the shipping that is used to used as a ferry service, used as communication between the mainland of Greece and its hundreds of islands. And, you know, that's part of the whole necessary transportation grid of the country. But the Greek ship owners like Latsis, Onassis, Niaxos, these are famous names. These ship owners are completely an integrated part of the city of London. And that's how they're perceived in Greece. They're not perceived as Greek patriots. You know, there's a few of them that are, but they're seen as tools of the British. Because the city of London, if you look at the city of London, what you have in the city of London, you have the banking interest. Well, it's the seat of the British Empire, right? And the British Empire was based on the trade of natural resources and speculation. And that was the basis of its banking system, this oligarchical banking system. And in the city itself, this square mile, is where you find not just the banks, but you find the shipping firms. All the Greek shipping firms have their offices in the city of London. Then you have the insurance companies, because the way it works is that you want a shipload of oil, you go to the bank to get the financing, you go across the street to charter the ship, and you go down the street to get the insurance. And the Greek shipping industry is primarily involved in shipping of petroleum and natural resources, bulk carriers. So it's totally part of the spot market and the British Empire's natural resources monopoly, basically. And so that's actually a problem for Greece, because if you take the case of the ship owner, Latsis, now this guy owns three or four ministers in the government, including the finance minister. He went to school at the London School of Economics. He supports financially the former king of Greece, King Constantine. Now, the former royal family of Greece, of course, is the royal family of Prince Philip. So the former King Constantine is the best friends of Prince Charles, and he is the godfather of Prince William. So, and of course, they all welcome on Latsis's yacht. No, so this guy Latsis also has a bank in Greece, and he has a private bank in Geneva, private investment bank. And the people who run this bank are the former management team of Coates Bank. Now, Coates Bank, everyone remembers, was the bank of the royal family. It probably isn't anymore because it's no longer an independent bank. I think it was bought by one of the commercial banks.
Morgan.
They all became, excuse me?
Morgan.
Right. So, and this management group left the Coates Bank because, you know, they weren't playing safely with the oligarch's money, which was deposited there. So this is who the Greek ship owners are. And they're not very well liked in Greece. And they're part of this, they're part of the enemy image that the Greeks have. Who they see are responsible for the current crisis.
Well, that's vivid, all right. And the thing is, it's need to know, because it's not as if they're so powerful. It was one thing to say. I mean, they're entrenched. They're infective. They've been around. But let me ask you, John, because part of the apparatus that has been functioning for this kind of crowd includes the Treasury Secretary Geithner. Now he's trying for Geithner too, more bailouts to this system. But I understand that, to use Mr. LaRouche's terms earlier today, I wasn't there, but there's a poison of pessimism. It doesn't mean that they can succeed. This is the end of the line, and we have tremendous tasks to do, but we have, it's not a matter of a lottery. We do it and we can succeed, right?
The British Empire is in the process of committing suicide. It is, you have a global empire. Globalization, its whole thing is built on controlling world trade and controlling world finances. Okay. and it is killing the world. So by their standards, what you're going to have is you're going to have a massive contraction. And when you, of populations, of business, of finance, of everything. So you have huge consolidations coming in every field and all of that. But you're setting into motion, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And there's no police state power on earth which is going to protect even the oligarchy from diseases that are going to. So you're setting off a biological holocaust as well as a financial holocaust. You know, all of these things, the empire is blowing up the world because while they're very clever, they're incredibly stupid and they're insane. And this is what they're doing. And this is what's going to happen to the world unless we intervene. And so the pessimism is, as we go down this path, we're basically dead. But the optimism comes because we're creative human beings and we know how to get out of this mess. We don't have to go there. So we can let the British Empire collapse. We'll help them collapse. The world doesn't need them. Put them in a zoo somewhere. Shut down Wall Street. Shut down the city of London. All of these.
Yeah, these theme parks, you know, instead of having old Williamsburg Village, we can have old Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, if you want to have a medieval structure in the middle of a modern society, it should be in a theme park. You know, and then, you know, we have the plan to rebuild. So, and people are getting more and more fed up. You look in the United States, the political parties, both political parties are dysfunctional. They're corrupt. They're useless. They're not doing anything to help the country. They're selling us down the river. You've got a president who's a fascist, who's insane, who is a complete liar. You know, if you compare what he says to what he does, there's a complete disconnect.
Yeah, what? I want you to continue that thought, but one thing, since both of you are speaking, let's take the something that, you know, it's kind of like for our own people, do we have the sense to get in out of the rain? Well, the Disaster Relief Fund, that's called DRF, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, operates the Disaster Relief Fund. That's what you do when, whether it's to help evacuations and put up shelters or rebuild a sewer system out in the Mississippi, a town. That, do you know, John, that's coming down to zero this Monday. You know, it might have $50 million left in it. That's all. It's because the White House will not, you know, because of directly what Obama's doing. It's true, the Congress has it all gummed up for just the reason you said, the parties, everything. But go ahead, please.
Well, you know, you see what the effect that Katrina had on Bush. The fact that the Bush administration didn't care what happened to New Orleans. Well, the Obama administration thought they learned something, and so when we started having these natural disasters, after an unseemly delay, Obama tried to get out on the top of it and act like he was in charge.
Yeah, I'll quote him during Irene, "I will do all in my power to help." Well,
right.
That's
about, but he's not doing anything.
Yeah.
So, and you have, we're entering into a galactic period where you have more and more extreme weather. The density of these events is increasing. And the Obama administration is not doing anything to help the people here. That we're not doing anything we can do to try to forecast these events. We're shutting that program down. We're not providing the aid that needs to be provided. You know, we've got a country which is increasingly bankrupt. We'll give trillions to the banks. But, you know, if you get flooded out, or hit by a tornado or something, hey, you know, you're on your own.
Oh, we're suspending the aid.
So this, all of this, this series of physical disasters is going to be Obama's. This is Obama's Katrina. And, you know, you don't have to be a politician to understand that when these things occur, the government, the responsibility of the government is to step up and help the people. And if it won't do it, then that government needs to be replaced. Obama's got to go, and the people in Congress who are watching the nation collapse and doing nothing except trying to cut their own deals. They've got to go too. And if they go, which we get rid of this, you know, it's like the problem is the dog has a bad case of fleas. You give the dog a flea dip, and then you're on the road to recovery. And that's what we need to do with this.
Right. And I think just one thing that one thing here is that Mr. LaRouche and his ideas and association and collaboration around the world are the biggest threat to these people. You know, you talk about who has the power. That's it. And, well, Dean, let me ask you more. You may, in the final minutes, you may have things you want to make sure and get in. But in your participation at this policy discussion at the University of the Aegean, I forgot the city where that's located, but you, what were the what about the development perspective of right across the waters there in Africa? Did you discuss that with people about the whole Eurasian development, just as you were going through the strategic benefit of Greece's experience, history, and location? This bears on what on the potential for Africa, right?
Oh, exactly. But first of all, the conference was in Athens.
Oh, okay.
And the friend who invited me there was Dr. George Sobonoglu,
mm-hmm.
and he is a professor of sociology from the University of Aegean, which is on the island of Lesbos.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been talking to him for about 6 months on the whole LaRouche program and the situation in Greece. So he said, well, we have to get this somehow into the Greek debate. So he was organizing an academic conference this summer, and he invited me to speak. And he's not your normal, you know, people think, you know, when you think of sociology, you think of Emil Durkheim and some abstract stuff that has no relevance to anything. But George is an entirely different person. He sees the way he practices sociology, he sees it as a powerful tool to analyze the problems that come up when you want to actually develop the country. Like, for instance, in Greece, the whole question, I mean, the agricultural sector in Greece is very weak in terms of the farmers. They're the least educated farmers in all of Europe. What would be very useful in Greece are cooperatives, agricultural cooperatives. They had agricultural cooperatives, but they really don't function for various reasons. So he has looked into these types of questions. So anyway, the point is, I mean, the conference itself had the title Supporting Sustainable Communities in Times of Emergency. So he wanted me to explain what the emergency was. So I went through the whole crisis, that this is not a sovereign crisis, but it's a systemic crisis of the collapse of the financial system. And then he asked me to elaborate on the solution. And at that point, in my presentation, I went into the whole idea of implementing Glass-Steagall, establishing a Hamiltonian credit system, and defining the types of projects, large projects, in the area of water, transport, and power that can actually bring the world economy onto a new scientific and technological platform. So, of course, I introduced all the large projects that we have been promoting. First of all, NOAPA in the United States, TransAqua in Africa, the idea of bringing water from the Congo River Basin into Lake Chad. You can develop one-third of Africa from the Sahel deep down into places like Kenya and the Congo and even Angola. And I also, of course, discussed the the whole idea of the Eurasian land bridge, which I mentioned earlier on this program, as well as these transportation corridors should go down through the Middle East, where we can link up the railroads with through the Middle East with Africa. We already know that the Egyptians have already built the railroad right up to the border of Gaza and the Sinai, and they're waiting for peace so that railroad line can continue right up through Israel, Lebanon, Syria, and Turkey and into Western Europe. I developed these ideas, and I said, well, Greece, you know, in ancient times when the Eastern Mediterranean was the most productive part of the world economy, Greece's strategic location, its seafaring capabilities, its relatively advanced culture, made it a powerhouse. And if you look at the map of the Eastern Mediterranean, as I mentioned earlier, Greece becomes a very, very important crossroads. If we're going to have the types of massive developments that we're talking about in the Eurasian landmass in Asia, the Suez Canal becomes a very, very, very important artery. Already the Chinese, in fact, have actually leased half the port of Piraeus, and to use it as a transport hub, the container port, for their exports into Eastern Europe. And they're actually investing in infrastructure there. The only problem is their wage scale and working conditions are a little bit too much like the working conditions in China. And the idea of simply exporting electronics and sneakers and this type of thing into Eastern Europe is not exactly what we need. Also, the Russians are interested as well. The Russians were interested in investing into Greek railways, and certain people said that I just read today that certain people said that before the bailout, Greece was looking for help, investment from Russia and China, and the EU prevented that. They told them not to do it. This has actually came up in Greece in the last couple of days. So anyway, this whole idea was very well received. I mean, I had other discussions. For instance, I had a discussion with a man who was the former chief executive of the National Railway Company, and he immediately saw the potential. And he immediately said, "This, you know, this is the future of Greece."
Well, that brings us to the final few minutes, and I'm just picking up on what you say and what John says. I'm thinking again, John, of this important announcement today in Russia at the United Russia Party Conference that Mr. Putin will become, you know, has made an arrangement with Mr. Medvedev, and Mr. Putin is to be president, say, next March, whenever this happens. And I'm just thinking that it was in the last 10 days, it's at a conference where the discussion where Russians and others, Chinese, were participating, and Mr. Putin was holding forth about the fact of the Arctic, that in fact there's more opportunity now for Arctic transportation. Now, the entire British Empire Green Movement has spent decades to say, oh no, Chicken Little, the sky is falling, the ice cap is melting, any opportunity for transportation in the Arctic is a sign that the Earth is overheating and we're all doomed. Just the opposite.
Yeah.
So again, if you want to state that these times in which we're in now, people, everyone listening, should redouble every effort they have. They've been acting to force the issue forward of Glass-Steagall, that has to be reenacted. Forget the numbers and the math. I mean, there are 41, 42 signatures now on the House on the House side for H.R. 1489, get Obama out of the way. But that's the orientation of the potential in Russia with China, with the U.S. Now's the time to act.
Yeah. You cure the disease by dealing with the financial system and this dysfunctional, these British Empire puppets in office. And then you begin the real development program. And that's because ultimately it's physical economics which determines our standard of living, not all these financial games. And so that's where we have to put our attention. We have to go back to building. We've been tearing down not only the United States, but much of the rest of the world. That's got to stop. We've got to go back to building. We put in this global transportation grid, which connects almost every continent. And with high-speed rail, you have to develop the interiors. You raise the standard of living of all the populations. And you break the control of this tiny little financier oligarchy over the planet, and then we go on, we have an explosion of a new renaissance. And it's all there for the taking, it's all there for the doing. You know, we just have to cure our little disease.
Okay, well, in other words, kick them while they're down. And the thing is, we go for the support, the activation, the financial support, you know where, have several EIR online subscriptions, give to your political action committee, and go for it. And I really want to thank for this firsthand report and for what you're doing there in Europe. Thank you, Dean Andromedis in Wiesbaden. Thanks.
Okay, you're welcome.
And John Hofel here in the studio with us. So this will be the closeout of the LaRouche Show for September 24, 2011. Thank you very much.